This is the Senate Judiciary Committee. The date is June 27th, 1989, 1:30 p.m., Hearing Room 343. We have a work session on Senate Bill 690, House Bill 2986. Public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2375, 2495, 2666, and 3352.
And we're here to take up the, where's the fish? We have a work session relating to fish.
Ah.
This bill came to us from the Ag Committee. We had a semi-blow-up about it with some of our coastal representatives and senators.
He's on his way to get a couple of those representatives.
Oh, they're actually coming?
Pardon me, Hanneman.
They're going to come.
Senator Brennan going to come up here and kiss the ring?
Let's get them.
You better get some more people up here.
We better get some more people up here. You don't want to do the fish?
I've never supported limited animal anything. And that's what this does.
Yeah, it's the current end. Okay, well, then we need to get Brenneman here.
Yeah, this is his bill now, isn't it?
Well, he's lukewarm about it, actually.
What?
Okay, let's try another one then, until we... we may be here a half an hour quickly. Which relating to... let's try 2495. This is here because it's going to be a gut and stuff.
Oh,
yes. And one of the bills that we worked on relatively diligently here was the reporting of sex crimes on the lead system. And we may have to get yet another vote on that one, too, if Springer's a vote. You were, and I vote on that finally. Mm-hmm. In the House committee, they just sort of dispensed with it after one hearing, and that was the end of it. So I thought since this was an effort that committee spent a lot of work with, it was a high priority of the local law enforcement people, of the sheriffs, and people had worked with it, so I had some drafted to send it back over to them so that they could get a clear vote on it.
We can't keep the first 11 lines?
We don't want to keep the first 11 lines.
Some people in the House did.
Yes.
The amendments that we have now.
Actually, the House now has there is a Mason's rule around that says you can't combine even though they may fit under the same relating clause. The House is getting very finicky about.
I thought Mason was dead.
No, Mason's been revised.
Okay.
And revived.
The manual.
The manual.
I know. I know what he's talking about.
Actually, he was frozen.
He knows what I'm talking about. I guess that's here for us to see what the committee, as a vehicle, whether the committee wanted to go ahead and do that or not, and whether you were satisfied. It is the exact bill that we sent over in, what was
667.
Senate Bill 667.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hill.
I would move the amendments described as House Bill 2495-1 amendments to House Bill 2495.
Okay, are there discussion of Senator Hill's motion to move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2495, the effect of which is to replace Senate Bill 667 that we've passed, if not unanimously, pretty closely, and it is exact, Jack, right?
Yes.
Are there objections to Senator Hill's motion? Hearing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill 2495 as amended to the floor if it do pass recommendation.
Senator Hill has moved House Bill 2495 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Call Senator Brennan.
Have Representatives Dix and Miller given this their blessing, or is this going to be a little surprise?
Well, we notified them.
I gave them notes today, Senator Springer, informing them of that.
And if they...
It's always nice to know before you have it.
Yes, we did. We did, and if they choose, we'll be in negotiation with them, find out if they want their names removed, or, and it would have the Senate Judiciary Committee is replaced as sponsor.
Sponsor the House bill.
Yes, it doesn't really work, does it? They were notified.
Vote's aye.
Okay, call the roll, please, Pat.
Senator Brenneman?
Aye.
Senator Brockman?
Aye.
Senator Grinsky? Senator Hill?
Aye.
Shoemaker? Springer?
Aye.
Pillar?
Motion, aye, motion carried, thank you. Okay. We're waiting for trees for Senator Grinsky. We're waiting for 690 for Senator Hanby. We're waiting for the fish people. Oh, here's Senator Dukes. The only fish person we have today. Come on up, Senator Dukes, on House Bill 2986. Senator Brenneman, this is the fish bill.
This is it.
Yeah, this is it.
Gotcha.
Your bill, John.
And I do have some amendments now.
I hope you can explain.
For the record, yeah. And as I understand it, these are at the request of a consortium of members.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Joan Duke, State Senator from District 1. And you may remember that when House Bill 2986 came to you, it had an amendment in it that came from Fish and Wildlife, and some of us were real concerned about what it did. In particular, the biggest impact seemed to be on commercial gill netting, that it looked as though we could not have any new permits, that is, if somebody needed to transfer one or something along that line, that we were concerned it might not, they might not be able to do it, and we would slowly get rid of gill netting through the back door. And if we're ever going to do that, I hope we do it through the front door. So anyway, you kindly held it over for us to get our act together, and I think we've done that. The Dash 5 amendments you have before you are something new, actually, in gill netting. They allow for a lottery process such as that that's in existence now for trollers. If gill netting permits, which are now at 350, get down below 300, then the method for instituting new permits is by a lottery system. And I am probably the least prepared person to be here explaining all of this, but the other folks are all in Ways and Means. I can tell you that I do not know where Fish and Wildlife is on it, and that was my last contact with the other people, the fishing folk around the Capitol, who have all agreed to these amendments. The last response I had was, we don't know where Fish and Wildlife is, but I can tell you that Representative Hanneman and Representative Hanlon are in agreement on these, and so is Salmon for All, which represents the gill netters as an organization, and I think they're good amendments, so I hope that you will remove the offending wording from the 2986 as you received it and insert this.
Okay, thank you. We do have someone from the, I think, Fish and Wildlife Division, is that right?
No, representing.
Oh, Hanneman and Hanlon. Okay, come on up. Introduce yourself for the record. That would be useful.
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Otto Husing. I am a legislative fellow working for the Coastal Caucus. Today I'm here just to say that Senators Bradbury, Representative Hanneman, and Representative Hanlon are busy in Ways and Means right now. Couldn't come up, but they thoroughly support the amendments to the bill as is. That's all I'd like to say at this time.
And that's the Dash 5 amendments for the record.
Right, just pinch hitting for them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else, Jack?
No.
And the whole question of penalties is in order and checked out?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll move the amendment.
Great. Senator Brennan has moved the Dash 5 amendment to House Bill 2986. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay.
Madam Chair, I'll move the bill to the floor. Be passed.
Great. Thank you. Senator Brennan has moved House Bill 2986 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yes.
Maybe there should be some discussion.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I have a question for Senator Brennan. I made my opposition to the portion of this bill clear to you. These amendments don't seem to do it. They just put it in different. I made the statement to the committee, Senator Grinsky, that I do not ever support bills that contain limited entry. And these amendments sort of still do, as far as I can see. I'm not opposed to the amendments, but I think I'll oppose the bill.
Okay.
What is discussion?
Discussion.
Limited entry is one that I've struggled with for three sessions, and I've made a determination not to further any more, real support and added additional limited entries. However, this speaks to the current limited entries that are on the books, and actually what it does, it addresses the situation that falls below through death or whatever, and shows how it can be increased again or slots filled. So in a way, it's actually increases the opportunities. There are some other provisions in the bill for the STEP program, which is really the issue that we were talking about before this loophole got closed. And some of this discussion is for Senator Grinsky's behalf, since he's not faced this issue before as a senator. He may choose to make a decision on limited entry now, too, if that's the case. Well, I just wanted to maybe kind of inform you a little bit on the history, because it is probably a fairly major issue in terms of fisheries in the state. The other way to manage, Senator, is to manage the resource by limiting the take about whoever's in the fishery, and when your quotas are filled, then you stop fishing. So it is a rather meaty issue.
Probably that we're not going to deal with it here.
Fishy.
Straight up. Okay. Further comments?
Madam Chair.
Senator Springer.
Did we get any yay or nay or I don't care from ODFW?
Jack, you got an I don't care, right?
They got somebody here.
Essentially.
Do you want to come up?
Where are we? Dash 5 amendments.
They have been adopted.
Have been moved and adopted.
And the bill is, there's a motion to go do that.
I kind of hate to have them drive all the way down.
Okay, we have not yet.
Okay, briefly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kay Brown with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We have reviewed the amendments, and we have no problems with them. The one thing that we would like to call to the attention of the committee is that there has been in 1981, there used to be a lottery for gillnet permits. There was specific legislation passed at that time because there were federal monies available to buy back gillnet permits in the amount of about $750,000. We used that money to buy those permits back. We don't know what the effect of the legislature now changing the law would be on the, how the federal government would view that, but they, we did pass specific legislation in order to obtain those monies to buy gillnet permits back and reduce that fleet. That's the only comments that we have.
I guess I understand why people get so frustrated.
Well, Madam Chair, that kind of raises the question whether or not we're going to get a big fat bill from the federal government for $750,000. Is that what you're saying?
Well, we simply don't know what the effect might be, but that certainly could be the outcome.
But you're going to let them come through the back door just fine with leaving the loophole open?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Well, I understand one of the reasons for this amendment was that someone could trade on the size of their boats and get permits when they were not necessarily eligible to get a permit. And that was the theoretical rationale for why the department introduced these kinds of amendments in the beginning, down in addition to the step bill.
Madam Chairman, I don't agree that that was the rationale. I think there was some misunderstanding that the amendments that were proposed would eliminate the ability of a vessel owner to transfer their permit to another person or for the permit review board to make some decisions that would allow for someone to retain their permit.
Have you not raised this with everybody, including the other members of our committee and our staff during the meantime? Do you not want the bill? You want the bill killed?
No, we do want the bill. We do agree. We don't have a problem with the amendments as they are proposed. We simply wanted to bring it to the attention of the committee.
Well, why didn't you bring it to the attention of somebody in a different format than? I mean, I just guess I don't understand.
Well, we did bring it to the attention of Representative Hanlon. We also passed the message on to Senator Brenneman's office.
Do you want us to vote yes or no?
We would like this bill.
Thank you. Well, I don't know. It's real tough.
I'm not asking. It's a personal question, okay?
She wants a no vote on the amendment.
She wants a no vote. I mean, she wants a yes vote, I think, on the amendments and the bill. I don't know what they want yet.
Madam Chair?
Senator Brenneman.
My understanding in working on this, the issue was raised with the group. There's a disagreement over whether that will be the effect, and those proposing the amendment and brought it forward disagree with that position and are asking that it be passed. That's a whole upshot right there.
Thank you. We have a motion by Senator Brenneman that we send House Bill 2986 to the floor with a due press recommendation.
As amended.
Call the roll, please, Pat.
Senator Brenneman?
Aye.
Brockman?
No.
Brinsky?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Shoemaker?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. I do want to say that it's real clear to me that people need to work a little harder on there.
Madam Chair?
Fish work, yes.
I appreciate the indulgence of the committee to help this get on its way. And you know there are always issues that are fairly complicated.
Yes, we do.
Wide range of views.
Right. Okay.
Could send us back to Ag and Natural Resources.
Okay, good. So I was going to say, if Springer didn't get this covered in the Ag and Natural Resources with two members here, then...
We didn't.
Okay. Let's deal with... ready for... You want to do the pet bill?
We can.
Or do you want
Senator Hamby is here.
Oh, Senator Hamby's here. Okay. Excuse me. Senate Bill 690, Senator Hamby is here.
We got another banker's bill.
No, we have. No, this is a Jim Markey. He looks like a banker, but he isn't a banker.
Madam Chair, if I could postpone it just 15 minutes.
Sure.
Do we have another bill?
Sure, yes.
We're just going to run over to the typewriter and clarify one thing.
Okay.
And be back. So it's
tree spiking?
Okay.
Felony tree.
Can we go down there?
It's Senator 20. Grinsky, you can go down there. Yeah. Don't go too far.
Yeah.
Which?
2495, I was here.
That's the dash that we, yeah.
The
we
dash
have.
One. I know. The 2495 was originally.
Would you like to be recorded as
I
an
would.
I vote? Okay. Senator Shoemaker would like to be recorded as an I vote on the amendments and House Bill 2495. Pat, are there objections?
Looks like Senator Sees.
Not seeing.
Hearing none, so ordered. Okay. Jack.
Madam Chair, on House Bill 2375, the tree spiking bill, there is one minor amendment. I have not had an opportunity to sort of show the
part of the death penalty or
Trust us. Trust us.
Those are mentally retarded, I think, so merge these bills.
It's coming in the House bill.
Ready?
We're ready.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Ron Grinsky, State Senate District 25. Regarding House Bill 2375, this is what's known as the tree spiking bill. As I'm sure most everyone is aware, if you stick a metal object in a tree, you may not be committing any crime whatsoever, and Jack can clarify that, but if you're doing anything, you may just be damaging personal property, which would be a minor offense. And of course, the ramifications are potentially serious in that these tree spikes may not be found until the tree is cut, in which case it could refract off of a chainsaw blade, or it also could have the same effect on a bandsaw blade in a plywood plant when the tree is cut up. That's what led to the inception of this bill, because this is becoming a common practice by certain what are known as eco-terrorists, basically. There have been a couple incidents where this has actually occurred and has blown up a bandsaw blade on two different occasions in mills in Oregon. What it does, in essence, is it creates, at a minimum, a Class C felony for putting a metal object in a tree. And then if you have any of these objects, it can be up to a Class A misdemeanor. It's pretty self-explanatory. It's a good idea. Any questions?
Senator Springer.
Let me make sure I understand Section 3, and maybe council can help me out. Say, one of our friends, maybe one of your constituents, Bubba pickup or somebody's out there in the woods, and the back of their pickup has got some tools or other equipment, because maybe they're a carpenter. My brother happens to be a carpenter, and he's got a crummy, and he likes going up fishing or out in the woods. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that would be that person would be having their truck or vehicle, iron, steel, or other sufficiently hard to damage saws or wood manufacturing, mm-hmm. and that possession of that is an A misdemeanor. Does that mean that a police officer, if they saw somebody up on a country road or back in the woods with a pickup that had, this kind of hardware in it, that the officer could then stop that person and go through all that stuff? Or?
Well, theoretically, I think the officer could make an argument for probable cause, but I think that they would probably require a little bit more than that, in that Section 3 does require that a person has to possess it with the intent to use it in violation of Section 2. I would think that it would lead to more than merely hauling it around on a country road. Don't ask me what it would be, because I'm not exactly sure. I think you'd have to be, walking towards a tree or have the spike perhaps on the outside of the tree and be on the verge of hitting it
in
there.
Not putting up a sign or advertising the latest concert or anything like that?
well, I suppose there's always some extreme examples that...
No, this is helpful to me. I hear you.
Okay. The language, though, is the intent to use in violation of Section 2 is the safeguard. I think as a practical matter, it's going to be you'd have a hard time pinning somebody with that. I think we're basically talking about an enforcement mechanism where someone comes upon somebody who is actually in the process of putting one of these in a tree. I don't know how else it could be done without some inside information.
That would be an attempt, though, wouldn't it? That would be attempting this crime if you saw someone about.
Well,
it would be attempting.
Maybe he hasn't struck. Excuse me. Maybe he hasn't struck the spike yet with the hammer. He's just holding it there. He hasn't attempted it yet.
Well,
Would this be? Let me ask counsel if I may. Would arguably, if someone damaged or caused injury to a tree, and I think we're not talking about just seedlings, we're talking about fully grown trees, mm-hmm. would that be criminal mischief?
If you damaged a tree in this manner?
Or could you argue that was negligent manslaughter or an assault if it was done recklessly?
Arguably, it could be assault.
Currently, you mean?
Currently, yeah.
Currently, yes, I think that's what the discussion has always been. Could you not actually go ahead and file charges against people under current law? And probably, the answer is probably you could, right, Jack?
You could, it would probably, there would be some practical problems in obtaining a conviction, but you could file charges, and in some cases it could probably be successfully pursued.
The fact is, this clarifies it.
If I could respond briefly, that is the case if someone is actually injured, but we want to deal with the people that are doing it before someone gets hurt. And in the lucky case where we were to come across a law enforcement officer or a Forest Service agent were to come across someone actually doing this, there's really very little they could do. The infraction would be so small that it's really not much of a negative incentive to keep these people from doing this. And that's why we wanted to make sure that we could get them before someone actually gets hurt.
If I go camping, though, and I always am very dismayed, Senator Grinsky, when I go camping and I find all these nails that people have hammered into trees to hang up whatever they hang up. And I guess that's the most relevant issue that I would have concern about this bill is I would have to then, if a Forest Service person came to get, I would have to prove that I was really hammering that spike in to keep the bears from eating my food rather than an intent to bodily hurt anybody. Is that right? Is that where we come down to if somebody...
Food in a tree when you go camping?
Well, Madam Chair.
If you have bears around, you sure do.
It has to be placed there with the intent to cause inconvenience, annoyance, or alarm to any other person.
Okay.
I don't think that would probably qualify for that. You know, anytime you come up with a new offense, it has to be fleshed out as to where it could apply. I don't think that you'd see it in that case, though.
It may be appropriate to make some legislative history to address the chair's problem that the annoyance, alarm, and inconvenience are of the serious nature of hurting someone and not simply, as the chair said, that she's bothered by the fact that people pound a lot of nails in to hang up their lanterns and that type of thing. I think
we're talking.
Want to affirm that.
Yes, I would certainly agree with that as one of the co-sponsors of this bill and the chief sponsor of an identical bill from the Senate. The intent is to deal with those spikes or metal objects that are driven into trees intended to be harvested, not trees that might be someplace in a park where you're not supposed to be doing that either, or a campground somewhere. And it is intended, I think, to deal primarily with serious bodily injury, although it would deal with property damage, too. A timber faller might not necessarily be injured, but the chainsaw could be destroyed if it were to come across one of these spikes, and I think we need to deal with that as well.
Secondary property damage, not any purported damage to the tree itself.
Correct.
Okay. Anything else that we need to have for the record to clarify?
Just a sort of a postscript in that last discussion, I would think that one of the purposes of tree spiking is intimidation, so that if the loggers find one tree spiked within a stand, they would be intimidated from proceeding with a logging operation because they don't know what they're going to find in the next tree. And I think one purpose of the bill would be to, that would be the type of inconvenience that I...
That's
annoyance and alarm that I think the bill gets at, would it not?
That's correct also, but what is also happening, Senator, is it's requiring these people to use metal detectors before they go in to start logging, and that's a major inconvenience. That's how they're finding the spikes in the logs once they get to the mill, too.
Yeah.
And as you've seen those things, you can't just roll them around to find spikes. It's maybe you'll find them, maybe you won't type of a deal, not to mention the manpower that's expended there.
Okay. Jack.
The amendment I drafted, Madam Chair, the -A2, changes the language the committee may want to consider on line 10 from bodily injury to serious physical injury. There is the main reason for doing that. It does raise the standard a little bit, but the primary reason is simply because bodily injury is not ordinarily the term used in criminal law. And serious physical injury is used in the assault statute, so it's made to track with them.
Senator Grinsky, do you have any problem with that?
No, I think it's a good idea.
I have another question. Would it, if there were a conspiracy to spike trees. Would our regular conspiracy statutes get at that? Would that already be a crime? Because I would see that that might be something we'd want to reach as well, is people who...
Not in this bill, Senator Schumer.
Not in this bill, but would it be reached under existing law? I suspect that it would be.
I believe conspiracy has the potential of covering every substantive crime, Senator.
Okay, that was really my question.
As does attempts in response to Senator Hill's.
Okay, further comments? Senator Grinsky?
Madam Chair, I'd like to, first of all, move the Dash A2 amendment to House Bill 2375.
Are there objections to Senator Grinsky's moving the A-2 amendments to 2375? Hearing none, so ordered. And I do want to pay special thanks to Jack, who's worked hard and diligently searching over not only this bill, but all of them that we've worked to sort of fix up little things like this that really, I think,
We've been fortunate in our selection of counsel on this committee.
Yep.
I'd also like to go ahead and move House Bill 2375 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Grinsky has moved House Bill 2375 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
This one's for the bill.
It's for Senator Grinsky.
Senator Hill, too. He's on the other one.
Senator Hill, yes. You are on.
Forms themselves. This is a rather complicated process, but it has been carefully negotiated out in the House. We've worked on it most of the session. We believe we have a bill that will work, and we urge your support. I'll be happy to answer any questions. And Mr. Ryder is here from our association, who is the lawyer for our association, and he will go through the bill in detail if you wish.
Senator Grinsky.
Real briefly, how would this work with regard to priorities?
With regard to, Madam Chair, Senator Grinsky, under current law, the life of a writ of garnishment is 60 days from the date of issuance. Now, we talked with the State Court Administrator's office about that early on. They do not want to change the life of a writ. So we've left that intact, and when you talk about priority, you're talking about multiple garnishments, which almost never occur anyway. But if I were a creditor and issued a garnishment on July 1, that would run for 60 days. If subsequently there were a garnishment issued 5 days later, there would be a notice sent from the employer telling me that there was already one in effect, because you can't have more than one in effect during the same 60 days. And it would also tell me what day it expired on. The second garnishment would take effect on the 61st day and would run until 60 days had elapsed from the date of issuance of the second one. The second garnishment has priority over a third or fourth. Now, a second garnishee or garnishor would have the option of letting that garnishment stand, and in this case it would run for 5 days, or he could withdraw it, and that's on page 1, lines 15 and 16, he can dismiss the writ and issue one later in the 60-day period that the first one is in effect to pick up more than the 5 days. If he does that, he runs the risk of somebody else coming in ahead of him. But it's totally at the creditor's option, and we believe it should be. That's the kind of thing that we deal with now all the time.
Would it be possible for a creditor to renew or re-execute a second garnishment on the 59th day, assuming that their debt hadn't been paid in full?
Madam Chair, Senator Grinsky, we addressed that problem in the House and were concerned about it, and Legal Aid was concerned about it too, in that somebody might take a 60-day writ and make it go forever. We've prohibited a plaintiff or a judgment creditor from issuing a second writ during the time that his 60-day writ is in effect, so that a plaintiff can never issue two during that same 60 days. That language is on line 19 and 20 of page 1 of the bill. It's an out-and-out prohibition against doing that, and we believe that's fair. This bill, to add to that, under the present system, if a person is working out here in the cannery and is getting paid every Friday, we have people who go after him every Friday with a writ of garnishment, because it has to be served on the day that he gets paid. And the defendant or the judgment debtor winds up paying for the service and the issuance cost of that writ, which is $15, $16 a week, that is money which never gets applied to his debt. And so we have eliminated that cost for the debtor in this bill, and I believe that's why legal aid is here today.
That's all the questions I
have. Thank you.
Thanks.
Anyone else? Catherine.
Yeah, on page 1, line 28, you say no priority shall be given to any previous plaintiff whose garnishment has been terminated. Does that mean, in your example, the second one coming in with a six-day period that they can garnish, that if they queue up again, come back in, issue another garnishment, that a third, fourth, fifth, sixth garnisher would always have priority over them?
Madam Chair, Ms. Weber, our intention with that language was that to say that there was no special priority given just because you had served the first one. The priority on that writ issued by the original plaintiff would take the same priority that anybody else would, and it's priority by the order of service.
But it says priority based on time, and then down here it says no priority should be given. Does that, and your intention then is not to totally knock them out of any subsequent priority?
The answer to your question is yes. It is not our intention to knock them out of any other priority. It is to put them on an equal footing with everybody else and give them no special priority just because they were the first one and had the original 60 days. That is not going to come up very often, but it's a good question and it deserves addressing.
I had another question. Up in section 2, there's lines that say, let me see, lines 8 and 9. The garnishment shall be a lien and continuing levy on earnings due or to become due to the defendant at the time the writ of garnishment is served on the garnishee. And then down in the next paragraph, it's ongoing language. Since the date of the issuance of the writ in line 14, is there any intention to have those two paragraphs different? Or is it redundant language only?
If I might field that one, my name is Kenneth Ryder,
yeah.
And I'm the attorney for the Oregon Collectors Association. The purpose for this bill is to reach non-exempt wages that are due to the debtor as of the date that the garnishee receives the writ of garnishment, and those non-exempt wages that are going to become due in the next ensuing 60 days after the writ of garnishment has, or during the life of the writ of garnishment, which is 60 days from the date of issuance. So the writ reaches both the wages that are due, non-exempt wages, that are due at the time that the writ is served, and those wages that will become due to the debtor or defendant in the statutory language during the life of the writ, which is 60 days from the date of its issuance. I don't think that there's certainly no intent to create any sort of an inconsistency between paragraph 1 and paragraph 2, or subsection 1 and subsection 2 of section 2 of the Act. What the intent is to reach the non-exempt wages that are due to the debtor at the time that the writ is served and during the 60 days that the writ's life continues on. Again, as Mr. Marquis was saying, the reason that this is important to both debtors and creditors is because if we take $3 writ issuance fee, clerk issuance fee, and you tack onto that either $9.50 up in Multnomah County or $12.50 just about everywhere else, every time a writ of garnishment is issued, the debtor takes one step forward and then a half a step back in reducing the amount of the debt because they're going to be behind the ball $15.50 every time. What this bill is envisioned to do is eliminate that.
Okay, I want to stop. We already heard what it's envisioned to do. I think we're talking about technical questions here, and to make sure that the language either says what it does, or if it doesn't, we need to fix it.
Sure, I understand. My understanding and my belief is that it is, if anything, it's a redundancy and it is not an inconsistency.
Okay. I had another question on the form part. On page 13, line 4, the top checkoff relates to wages which will become owing to the debtor during the 60 days after the writ is issued. And then down on line 22, and this is to be, this is the form that's to be filled out by the garnishee. It talks about, I owe wages to the debtor which are not now due but will become due within 45 days. Could you explain the functioning of those two separate paragraphs and how they interrelate or don't?
I'll try that one again. Again, Kenneth Ryder. In line number 4, what we have is the following wages will become owing to the debtor during the 60 days after the writ is issued. So what that means, of course, is that this writ is envisioned to reach any non-exempt wages during the 60 days that the writ is in effect. When we skip down to to line 22 on page 13, that's fashioned after the current phrasing of the writ of garnishment, which is that a writ reaches property that is currently owing, that the garnishee owes to the defendant at the time that the writ is issued, but it's not payable for 45 days. And probably a classic example is a promissory note that there is property that is due, but it's just not payable. But it will be payable within 45 days, and therefore the creditor could reach that. In this particular example, what we're looking at is that we owe the garnishee owes wages to the debtor, but they're not now due, but they will become due within 45 days. And my belief is that in line 4, what we're doing is we're attaching continuing payments that are going to be made in the form of wages, non-exempt wages, of course, to the debtor during the next 60 days. And line 22 is just fashioned after the language that's currently in existence, that I owe a debt, but it's not payable, but it will be become payable within 45 days. I don't think that there's an inconsistency there. And as we discussed prior to earlier this afternoon, I view paragraph or line 22 as being more like I owe a one-time payment perhaps to a subcontractor. So I acknowledge, I as the garnishee, acknowledge owing wages or monies to a debtor that's not now due, but it will become due in 45 days. I don't think that that particular line, 22, is envisioned to be the same as a continuing employment relationship particularly. So in most instances, what the garnishee is going to be completing is line 4, which is that he or she, as the garnishee, owes wages and will continue to owe wages for the next 60 days during the life of the writ.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Well, let me double check and see.
Are there any directions in the forms to the garnishees about how to handle multiple writs? Or in the statute? In the statute, there's one. There's the one direction.
Yes, in the statute there is. I don't yes, believe there is in the form.
Madam Chair, Ms. Weber, I believe there is an instruction in the form with respect to receiving a second that they are required to send a notice. I don't know exactly where that is, but I believe that is.
Sir, you want.
And there's also, on page 13, a listing of the statutes that, in the instructions, that require those things.
I'm sorry, could you locate, I didn't get what you're talking about. You're talking about page 13, line 40?
Lines 40 and 41.
So that's what the garnishee would have to do, is check those statutes out to find out how to handle the multiple garnishments if they arrive.
If they had a question about it.
And there's no other reference in there. You said you thought there was one, Jim.
I thought there was a note. There was a.
I couldn't find it.
Okay,
I couldn't
maybe
find
it's not
it in the amendments,
it may not be
which actually apply to other forms, but.
I can tell you from a practical point of view that garnishees call the creditor or the creditor's counsel all the time to figure out how to fill these forms out, so I just anticipate that that will be an additional verbal question that would be fielded, which is not necessarily unusual at all.
That's all.
Okay, are there any other comments? Terry?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Terry Rogers from Legal Aid. I am not opposed to the bill. Mr. Marquis and Mr. Ryder and I worked out some amendments which have been incorporated in the Angros version of House Bill 2666. And basically, the amendments that you have today, the A5 amendments, incorporate the notes and warnings that we wanted in the forms and add them into and conform the various garnishment writs and forms that you already worked on in House Bill 2930. So with that, I did want to let the committee know that I am not in opposition to the bill and that Mr. Markey and I agreed that we would try to conform and have the forms all be the same, the continuing garnishment forms as well as the regular garnishment forms, to add the warnings that we agreed upon in the House.
Are there other? Senator Hill?
No questions, Madam Chair.
Catherine, are you satisfied, or do we need to rewrite this bill, or do we need a little more time, or what's your comment about it? I guess we could. If you think there are areas that need to be reworked, we can delay it. If I do think we need to, at a minimum, adopt the A5 amendments, and then. Okay, Senator Brennan has moved the dash A5 amendments to House Bill 2666. Are there objections?
That's what that bubble was.
No. I get to read them pretty good. Hearing none, so ordered. So ordered. Okay. Then Catherine, would you like to comment about?
Yeah, I think technically the bill could be made better, and we could probably do it by tomorrow. There are two or three areas. I think one put notice in about how to handle the continuing garnishments. Get rid of the redundant language, clarify that priority means that it doesn't mean no priority forever, but that it's only no special priority rather than no priority at all. I think that would improve the bill.
Okay. Folks out there have any comments about that? Since we're going to be amending it anyway, I guess we don't.
Madam Chair, I don't have any particular problem with the concepts that your counsel is talking about. I am a little bit concerned about time. We think the bill will work like it is.
The fact is that we have to adopt amendments anyway, so it still has to go for concurrence, even if we adopt these and go. And I suspect the difference of whether we pass it out today with these amendments or tomorrow with these plus whatever technical amendments you work out, it's not that in itself isn't. If we had a bill that didn't need any amendment at all, then you could say let's go. You don't even have to deal with concurrence. But committee's pleasure. Bill, you want to set it over and
why don't we? Could we pass it out conceptually and then if before it reaches the floor, we have any trouble with the amendments that Catherine drafts, we can bring it back. I don't think there's anything of substance for being dealt with, right?
Just
pass the bill out as amended by the A5 amendments.
We would have to move conceptual amendments we've moved the A5. I would also recommend that we need to move conceptual amendments as Catherine has noted.
Right.
And approve them with the proviso that we all will get a look at it before it goes to the floor, to the desk, and then we will pass the bill out, do pass with the conceptual amendments added.
Can we do that now?
Yes, we can.
I'll so move.
Okay. Senator Shoemaker has moved that we add conceptual amendments which will clarify primarily On page one, and Catherine, do you want to just go through the areas of concern that you're going to be addressing yourself?
Right. One would be with section 2(1) and (2), there's some redundant language in there relating to whether the writ only affects money payable at that time or money that accrues after. Make that consistent. Two would be to clarify that by priority, no priority shall be given to a previous plaintiff, meaning no special priority, and that that previous plaintiff could again queue up first in time, first in right. Number three would be to go into the form and I didn't say this before, but I think we might want to take another look at it, go into the form and make those two sections that we looked at, the 45-day and the 60-day one, make sure that they do say different things and that that is clear. And then number four, have a notice in the form to the garnishee what on how to handle continuing multiple garnishments that come in.
Okay. Given the fact that the last one may be a little too complex and we may abandon that and be satisfied with just the statutory recitation, which is what they have now. Okay. With that proviso, then, do we have any objections to adopting Senator Shoemaker's conceptual amendments as recited by Catherine? Hearing none, so ordered.
Okay. I'll move the bill as amended to the floor with the Dukat recommendation.
Senator Shoemaker is moving House Bill 2666 to the floor as amended. Again, we will check them by committee members to make sure you get a look at them, and we can bring it back if it isn't what the conceptual amendments seem to address. Okay, discussion. Call roll, please, Kiska.
Brenneman?
Aye.
Rothman?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Shoemaker?
Aye.
Springer? Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much, folks.
Thank you.
Now, we can get back to 3252 for about 10 minutes. We have a floor session at 3 o'clock.
Madam Chair, it sounded like we were real close before. I'd like to ask the proponents, perhaps one of them could speak to, whether or not they have any problem with the amendment proposed by Senator Shoemaker.
Yeah, and I do want to say that we have, Jack, you want to make a comment about Senator Yee and Senator Gree's constituent, Julie. Is it Julie Gazelle who's Senator Yee's constituent? You want to come up, Julie? And
I asked Senator Yee if she possibly could come and visit with us. She's preparing for a Ways and Means Committee. She did say that she supports the bill. I know she's got a little typed note, and there is an inaccuracy in that. The bill as amended would not include the second portion. It would retain the first, though, but she does support the bill.
Okay. And Julie, I guess you can bring whoever else you want to bring up, but it's got to be real brief. And I know there are people who've come from Tangent and someone from Portland. So I want to make sure that the folks from Tangent get on, and I guess Rebecca Miller from Lebanon is here. Great, thanks.
Madam Chair, if I might just real briefly, I owe Ms. Grisella an apology. She called me a couple times this morning, and I simply didn't have a chance to get back to her. So
that's okay.
Okay.
I'm here today representing victims of pet theft. I myself am a victim. My dog was stolen and taken to an animal dealer and shot and killed within 4 hours. I will be brief if I feel it is necessary that I can make a statement concerning this bill and the amendment. The USDA regulations already require random source animal dealers to maintain certain records concerning the animals they receive, and they fail to require a number of records without which the tracing of stolen pets is virtually impossible. House Bill 3352 corrects the situation by requiring dealers to, one, photograph the animals they receive, to obtain reliable personal identification for the animals from who they purchase animals, to verify that such individuals are lawfully in possession of the animals they wish to sell, and to make a record of the destinations to which animals are shipped after leaving the dealership. I'd like to point out that this local animal dealer that had killed my dog, recently this last fall had acquired 71 dogs from the Jefferson County pound. The U.S. Department of Agriculture did inspections requiring looking at his records, and in fact he only got 2 dogs from the Jefferson County pound. He could not account, according to his record, for 69 dogs. My question is, where did these dogs come from? It's very important you also know that we have worked with all the concerned groups to ensure that satisfactory compromise would be reached with each group. This is the reason for the amendments you see. In conclusion, the pet owners I represent throughout Oregon will go along with the suggested amendments. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
The only reason I am here
we need your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Rebecca Miller from Lebanon. My cat was taken under the theft by deception. The man brought his wife and his 2 children, told me that it would be a perfect home out in the country. The 2 children argued about who would sleep with the cat. I found out later the cat was sold that evening to the local animal dealer. When I tried to get her back, I called the animal dealer and I told him I didn't want any trouble. All I wanted was her back. I would buy her back. I would do whatever it took. And he asked me to describe the cat. She was very easy to describe because her abdomen had been shaved and she still had the stitch line. And he said he didn't have that cat, and if he did, I couldn't get her back, or he would not give her back anyway. And I said, could I just please come and look? And he said no. My husband went anyway. He was really busy, the animal dealer was. He went behind a truck with one of his workers and cursed at the worker and told him to get these blankety-blank cats out of the cage and in the truck because the feds were on their way for an inspection. While he was talking to this worker, my husband went into the kennel, and my cat was in there, exactly as we described her. My husband got in a confrontation with the man, and we took the cat. I later found out that these cats that he was loading in a truck were taken to an illegal kennel and held until the USDA inspection was completed and then shipped to San Diego, where a number of them died en route. The person who stole my cat, I contacted all of the authorities, said I wanted to press charges, was told not to bother, that nothing would be done, that it was a waste of their time and mine. I contacted the USDA. They knew this man. They said, oh, yes, we know he does this. He does it continually. I contacted his place of work, and he has notices up on all the bulletin boards where he works saying he wants a pet for his 9-year-old daughter and will give it a good home. So even though there are laws supposedly governing these people, they aren't working. And we need something else, and that's why we're here. Thank you.
Next, please.
All right, I'm Margie Person from Tangent. And my daughter and I also had problems with, we had 2 dogs, good-sized ones, that had disappeared from our home. We looked around for 3-4 days trying to find them and called a dog pound several times and couldn't. Finally, a lady from Humane Society informed my daughter to check at this man's place in Lebanon, which we did. My daughter and I drove into the yard. The older man met us in the yard. He was very rude. He says that he did not have the dogs, and we've had the dogs since they were puppies, and you can kind of tell their bark, and we knew that one was barking. We could tell his voice. But the man still says no, he did not have them. We asked if we could go look and see if he had them. No, we were not allowed to. A pickup pulled in right next to my car, and this younger man got out, and the older man rushed over to him very quickly, whispered something in his ear. The younger man took off towards the barn, just almost like a run. And the older man turned around and very rude remarks, and he went back to his house. My daughter and I, we pulled out of the driveway. We went to the place next door because we were going to get in touch with the sheriff. My daughter went to use the phone to see if the people were home, and I stayed out and I watched. And I could see very closely. That younger man came out of the barn, he went over to the truck, and he loaded our two dogs into the back of his truck. He took off towards the main road. I hollered at my daughter, she came running, we followed. We lost him when we got almost into Lebanon, we lost him. We didn't know where he was, but he knew that we were following him. He couldn't help but know it, because we were right behind him. My daughter and son-in-law went back to the place with the sheriff. They would not let the sheriff on the land. He could not go and look in the kennels either. There was quite a bit discussions about it. The next morning, our two dogs were at the gate of our home. They didn't have their licenses on or their collars. They were real thin, and they, for about a week or so, it took us a long time to get them back to normal because they were cowering like they had been misused.
Okay. I appreciate it. Now, the committee has to go down to session in a minute and a half, and so we do need to ask you to shorten up your testimony. I appreciate that. We have two more folks. We've got Yvonne Simmons, who came from Portland.
We're pro the amendment a little bit, so right.
Thank you. Jack, you've been in the back room. Are there any other problems with these amendments?
The one additional concern is there is a provision in here allowing for inspection of reports at the Department of Agriculture, and I believe there are some folks who would like some additional language that would require a person going to the...
What amendments?
The hand and gross version, Senator.
There is a hand in gross version. Maybe it's not even got. Yeah, it's there. It's under there, right under that clip. We have a habit of putting the amendments first and the hand in gross bill second, folks.
We're on page 2, section 3, subsection 3 of the hand in gross version. This allows for a person to go to the State Department of Agriculture and basically go through the files to look for their lost animal. And there's been a suggestion made that a person doing that, a pet owner, would have to sign a statement saying he or she is in fact the owner of a lost or stolen animal, and that's the purpose they're looking for.
I don't think anybody has any objections to that. I wouldn't. People got to do that anyway. Are there objections to that amendment?
We'll move that conceptual one.
Okay. Right. Jack will move that amendment conceptually on line. I mean, Senator Hill moves it, and it will be inserted into line. But first you have to come up and get your name on the record, and then you can ask the question.
I just want to make sure I'm understanding things clearly.
Yes.
My name is Mary Lee.
Right.
What I'm understanding you to say is...